Give me your dog. In the transliteration on page 16, and in the translator sitter on page 14. So, found that in the transliterated sitter, it doesn't have actual, doesn't sort of like a poem, so it's kind of hard to tell which line is which. We were up to, Hino Adon Olam L'chol Notzar, the Rebbe who was all Malchuso, which is the fact that you can't daven since he's the master of the universe, and therefore, or master of the universe and every creature which is created, so therefore, which each all which indicates his greatness and his kingship, therefore you can't pray to anybody else. It's kind of a misleading statement that we mentioned last time. We met last week in the Yigdal because the Yigdal just sounds like he's a great master, but in reality this is supposed to tell us that Hashem is not just a great master, but rather he's the only suitable entity to which one can pray. Other than, as we mentioned last week, one can make requests also of people.
Right.
One can make requests of people. One can make requests of anything else which exists. Not live people, not dead people, not anybody.
So what about?
I mean, not dead people. I mean, not malachim, not dead people. I didn't mean one people. Sorry.
What about if I have a pet dog who I train to give me the remote control, and I say, Spike, give me the remote control, and then he goes and does it?
In reality, you're not asking him.
I'm not asking him to get the remote control.
No, you're telling him to get the remote control. The dog can't distinguish whether you're saying please or not saying please.
What if I say to the dog, get the remote control, and he doesn't move?
That's because you trained them. It's a Pavlovian response.
So we assume, like also with monkeys and stuff, we assume that animals don't have the...
They don't have free will.
They don't have free will.
No, they don't respond to requests.
They don't respond to commands. And then they might or might not fill those commands. So what's the difference between command and request?
The davening was a request, not a command. You can't command. If you were able to command an angel, for example, it's a good question actually. Tzadikim, there it is said that Barizal and other Kabbalists were able to be mashbiach the malachim, or command malachim by taking oaths, which would require the malachim to fulfill their directives. That's okay if you can do it. because in that case, you're not praying for the malach, you're commanding the malach. That's perfectly legitimate.
So I say malach, make it rain.
Right.
If I can't say malach, please make it rain.
Right.
Seems a very gray line.
No, because, you know why? Because for you, to say malach, make it rain, is in essence a prayer. Because you have no capacity to command malach. Right. But if you actually had that capacity, I mean, you know, I don't know, maybe the Tzadik, we just don't know about it. But let's say, who knows? Kabbalah extensively. But assuming that you're not for the moment, I see from his face that he does. But assuming that you're not for the moment, as a big Kabbalist, so then when you say, you know, Malach, make it rain, it's a demand but not a command. And you can't demand of a Malach either. You can only command a Malach.
So what about an animal? If I'm about to be eaten by a mountain lion, I see a dog, and oftentimes people ask the dog to get help, even though they know the dog doesn't know what it's talking about, what you're talking about. Like, people do this all the time, so is it wrong? You shouldn't ask the dog?
No, fine. You're commanding the dog to get help. You can phrase it like a question, but you're commanding the dog to get help. You're not praying for the dog.
What's the difference between a command and a request then?
By an animal, there's no such thing as a request.
There's no such thing as a request.
No.
Because the request implies that the person or entity that's requesting will make a decision on its own.
Right. It understands that you're asking for something, and it chooses to either, you know, fulfill or deny your request.
But angels don't have free will either, so why can't they request?
It's not so true that the angels have no free will.
Well, the higher angels.
What?
Yeah,
but in essence, they're willful beings. But the point is, you're right. It's not a question of free will. I take that back. It's a question of whether they're intelligent beings and which can could receive, which can understand and perceive questions or not.
So golem, you could ask them
command also.
But they can think about it and decide whether or not they want to do it.
I don't think anything like that has ever been created.
No, not yet.
Right. So we'll worry about it when it happens. The idea is obviously that very serious about it for a moment. It's not so much the prayer which is forbidden; it's the regarding of another entity as a divinity. Prayer is what you do to other divinities, right? To a divinity. Whether it's the head divinity or a sub-divinity, that's what you do to a divine thing. So if you're praying to a angel, in essence you're saying, well, true God is divine, but there are other divinities. The same thing as that person. He's a divinity. But if you are making a request, even of an animal, you're not making the animal into a divinity. It was a dead animal. And you pray to the dead animal, then that would be Avodah Zarah. That would be idolatry and would be forbidden to do.
You know, could we kill him then?
What?
Could we kill him then? Oh, yeah.
In the right circumstances.
Then it's not work. All right.
Not in our day and age.
Oh,
we haven't just had hundreds.
Yeah. And generally speaking, from the, all the laws in the Torah, which people find unpalatable, they can just dismiss by virtue of the fact that they're not applicable in today's society, and therefore they shouldn't cause any theological difficulties.
Because that we want them to be?
Not necessarily. You don't have to want them to be.
Well,
you don't have to want to be able to kill people.
Well, but we want Mashiach, and we want them to send him to
come. Then nobody will sin.
True.
Right.
But a lot will be coming back.
Well, why should put him right to death then? No assumption. There's no assumption that necessarily we're going to have to start. I mean, there are people, of course, who would love to start killing people left and right with the license of the law. But there's no requirement. Rav Kook went so far, and I think he was incorrect about this. But Rav Kook went so far to say one need not look forward to the restoration of the sacrificial service in the Beis Hamikdash. One can look forward to that. An era in which the sacrifices will all be of vegetation.
Yeah!
Not of animals.
So I'm studying all these laws.
Kohanim don't like that. When
I don't like that.
I've
been growing my thumb out so I could, jab the bird.
Yeah, but I don't think he was right about that, Rav Kook. I think it was the statement was too far reaching.
Seems a little PC.
he was saying it's just when there was no need to be PC, but He, in my opinion, misinterpreted a couple of midrashim, which he got them to say because he wanted them to say that in the world to come, people will be vegetarian and all the carbonos will just be of vegetation, not of animals.
But there are plenty of Orthodox Jews who believe that.
What?
There are plenty of Orthodox Jews who go for vegetarian sacrifice after the Messiah. There's a minority
which
can go along with that, right? Absolutely.
Very, very teeny minority.
Small enough to have a little caucus?
Yes.
Okay, good.
There's the nutty vegetarian wing.
Yeah.
Rabbi Kook, though, I mean, he's a big name.
Yeah, but he ate meat. Only in Shabbos.
Oh.
There's a fellow though, Richard Schwartz, right, who lives in Staten Island, who's the head, the chieftain of the Orthodox vegetarian tribe. And he has written numerous books about Judaism and vegetarianism. And he is the head of the small movement that exists.
Staten Island?
Yeah.
He's wrong somehow.
You don't associate Staten Island with vegetarianism, right?
No.
Yeah. Meat eating Italians.
That's right.
In Staten Island, yeah. But I guess the Jews, in reaction to meat eating Italians, they're vegetarians. This guy happens to be a vegetarian. I met him once also. I've explained to you why Hasidim are half vegetarian, right?
Right.
Because you have to release the holiness from the food, from the meat.
Yeah, but that's...
From what?
From the whole chain, from the whole food chain. In other words, you get, when you eat the cow, you release the holiness from the grass that it ate and the water that it drank. So it's a much more effective means of releasing, elevating or releasing the sanctity. In fact, a chassid, I think probably a lot of us didn't believe that an animal is happy to be shechted. Yeah, it's against explicit Gemara. The Gemara says that animals are not happy to be shechted. There's a story about Rabbi Yudan Nasi in Kruvis, that Rabbi Yudan Nasi, a calf who was being led to slaughter, once came and hit and tried to hide under his coat. So they shouldn't take him to slaughter, and he said to the calf, "Go, for this you were created." And they took the calf, and of course, and they slaughtered it. And in Shemayim, they said that since Rabbi Yudan Nasi did not have mercy on this calf, so therefore he's going to suffer. And he suffered 13 years of terrible, terrible stomach ailments. So finally, one day, his maid was sweeping out the door of his house, some weasels, or rats, it's not clear exactly, you know, some sort of animal, and she was doing it in a particularly nasty way, and she said to her, let them be, Rachamova Koma Tosi, says, Shem's mercy is on all his creatures. And then they took away the suffering, because he had mercy blessed. So, from this we see several things. What's the matter?
It just seems to go completely against what everyone seems to think today. That an animal rejected is the greatest thing for the animal, and that's the whole reason why that animal exists, is for its purpose to be rejected. Like, so they did not be dead. This is their purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says that that's not good.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that's the thing. It says that that's not the case. That, that's what you know he said, right? And he was punished because he didn't have... Sufficient mercy on even the animals. Right? I mean, you could say, well, Rabbi Yudan Nasi, he's different, he's on a higher level, and therefore he held to a higher standard, but the bottom line is, we see that animals are not necessarily happy to go to slaughter. There is a source which says that animals are happy to be sacrificed, not slaughtered. Because it says, El Yohan Nabi and Mount Carmel, where they took two identical bulls for the sacrifices, him and the prophets, the false prophets of the Baal, so the calf, whatever it means, the calf, the bull which was taken for the false prophets of the Baal, the calf, whatever it was, complained to Elion, said, it's not fair. That bull is going to be made into a korban. And here I'm going to be made into Hashem, and I'm going to be made into a korban to the Baal, right? And Elion appeased the bull and said, don't worry, you're going to be just as much a part of the Kiddush Hashem, because they won't be able to get fire to come down from heaven and consume you, as the bull which will have fire come down and consume it. So this seems to indicate that there was some sort of, happiness on the part of the cow or the bull that was being slaughtered for the purpose of a korban.
But will we need karma? Because the whole point of karma is to come close to Hashem. In the Mashiach time, Hashem is going to be directly visible to everybody, right?
Only on Olamaba.
No, Olamaba. So there will be no sacrifices on Olamaba.
But we don't know.
We won't need them.
Right, we don't know. There might not be sacrifices on Olamaba.
Because if the whole purpose of the sacrifice is to bring us close, and we're already as close as we can get, or as our parents let us get, then the sacrifice wouldn't do anything.
Right, there might not be sacrifices on Olamaba.
But in Mashiach, that's not the case.
Right. It seems that a person is actually supposed to yearn for the restoration of the korbanos in all their gore and glory. So that's part of the hope. You don't have the hope to kill people, but you do have the hope to have some sort of restoration of the divine. That's the first thing that the Reform took out of the sitter, you know. The first thing they took out of the sitter way back in the 1820s, whatever it was korbanos. Because, it didn't...
Enjoy.
It's interesting. I think also we have to look around this topic. Much of the way Judaism is practiced today is backlash because of the Holocaust. We understand that, right? For example, the anti-secular studies... trend of the past 50 years or so is the direct result of the Holocaust, because the Germans were very cultured. And since they're very cultured and very knowledgeable, and yet they were horrendous and barbaric people, so therefore, there was a backlash against secular culture and secular studies.
That's the basis of the backlash?
Yeah.
Is there sources for that?
What do you mean, there are sources?
I mean, there are rabbis who said, we're not going to teach it in this system because of the Germans were cultured, and therefore we're not going to imitate them.
Right.
That's the reason.
Yeah.
As opposed to saying, the secularists were well educated, they brought on this catastrophe, and therefore we're not going to be like them.
No.
Okay.
Is that the evidence which they cite against Rabbi Hirsch's Cohen der Heretz approach?
As the, you know, the German experience.
Also, same thing, that since there is, I don't know if it's true or just, you know, convenient, I imagine it's true, but they say the Germans who at the same time were very cruel to the Jews were very kind to animals. They had pets, and, you know, they're very nice to their pets. So from this, there was a backlash in Judaism against the idea of kindness to animals, because you see that the Germans, with their kindness to animals, were hypocritical, and they were cruel to human beings.
Some might not have pets.
What?
That might almost not think people have seen have pets.
I believe so. That's one of the reasons.
Very few people have pets.
Yeah. So that's one of that is certainly a reason. So that all this falls in the category of the backlash from it's because the pendulum is going to swing the other way. Just a question of whether it's if Moshiach wouldn't come, whether it's in 10 years or 100 years that the pendulum will swing back the other way. But these are, you know, historic trends within Judaism.
So
go back and forth.
So you see a trend within Orthodoxy back towards secular culture?
Not yet.
But at some point,
there are some schools, right? Like in the modern
class,
there's like some schools that teach more.
No, I'm saying the traditional.
The hardcore.
Yeah. At some point, it'll swing back. You know, yeah. Just like it swung there at the beginning of the 20th century and then swung back, so it'll go to some point, it'll swing back again.
Now, at the beginning of the 20th century, did Lithuanian Orthodoxy integrate more of secular study?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
So, like, Lakewood, the way Lakewood is now,
than it was 100 years ago? It was not to this extent.
Like, most people would get a job.
Most people get a job, and, you know, people would even go to university. I have a great, great uncle, a very old man, he's not really functioning right now.
What's his name?
Dodi Yosef.
Oh.
So he has a BA in math from the University of Kufna. You know? And there was a whole active, he's a very, 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 he was a good exotic. He was a very learned man, and he was, a proper upstanding Haredi Jew. Mm-hmm. And in Lithuania, there were many of those types he immersed in the Tel Aviv Yeshiva who went on to college. You know, we don't associate, you think you came to America and went to college, but Lithuania, University of Kovna, University of Vilna, it was a Jewish, from students organization in Kolyaza in Lithuania, which is highly active.
Wow.
So,
college wasn't then like it is today in terms of
the strip. No, but that's the point. That's what I'm saying. The secular studies, of course, that's the way. College today is, a lot of people just to party, right?
Right.
The University of Kovna or Kaunas. Mm-hmm. Wild party scene, but
so you'd have to create a sort of a YU style university, but that's not just liberal arts, that's everything. That's like a real university, but with grown people, in order to have that situation again.
YU is a real university with grown people.
No, they don't have engineering.
They close
down
their
phone
department.
Daddy, look
at
X. Look at X. No math, they have no physics, they have no computer science, no chemistry, very little biology. It's basically liberal arts, that's all.
They have it. They used to have the Belfort Graduate School of Science, but they closed it down because it wasn't making enough money.
And it was only graduate school, too. They couldn't get an undergrad.
So, in any event, point is, how do we get on this topic of vegetarianism? Because we talked about death penalty and how we get the death penalty.
Sanhedrin,
yeah. I'm drawing a blank. How we match get from not dogging
to praying to animals. Asking animals.
Oh, praying to animals, right. Okay, praying to animals because you produce the death. That's right, that's how we got on topic. Okay, good. Okay, how do we change our race?
Dead. Now, look at, now I made an X out of yoga.
Very good. So now that we now that we got through with that, let's go on to the next principle. Next principle is the flow of his prophecy he gave to the his special people who are his glory. Let's see our translators here. His treasured, splendorous people. What about in the here it says, so the people, the abundance of his prophecy, did he grant to the people of his choosing and of his splendor. So this is a very fundamental principle in Judaism, like all the principles of the Rambam. There must be prophecy. It goes because otherwise, if Hashem does not communicate with human beings, the entire Torah collapses. So it's predicated on the assumption that events there occurred, meaning that there was communication between God and human beings, at least till the time of the Second Temple, till the beginning of the Second Temple period, and that this divine revelation forms the basis of our Torah Shebichtav, our written Torah, and to a certain extent also the Torah Shebaal Peh. Not as much as Torah Shebichtav, but primarily of Torah Shebaal Peh, not as much as the oral law, but primarily of the written law. The question is how exactly Nevuah occurs, and whether one should strive to be a prophet, even in our day and age. What?
It's useless. There are prophecy after.
It's useless. But Hasidus is based on the assumption that everybody can be a prophet.
They think of all Shem as a prophet?
No, not necessarily. Well, they would say yes. But not necessarily. But the point is, the question is, how you arrange your service of Hashem and your growth in Judaism. If you arrange it in a manner...
Look, I have 5 cents.
I see. So you arrange it in a manner which is geared on the prophetic scale, which is what the Mesilas Yesharim did. Mesilas Yesharim is a hierarchy, a ladder which leads at the pinnacle to Ruach HaKodesh, to divine spirit. So Mesilas Yesharim the Moshe Chaim Lutzatzel made a pathway which goes up towards prophecy. Or you build your religious progress on the assumption not that you're going to be a prophet, but that you're going to be a learned person, or an ethical person, or, you know, a well-functioning, well-rounded person. These are all issues which arise in a person's the planning of their life. And the Piatetzer, the Chodesh Talmidim, was a very wonderful paper on Chassidus, the student propagation in English. He said that really, as I mentioned, the basis of Chassidus is the assumption that everybody should strive for prophecy. Now, what does that mean? Of course, you're not going to be a full prophet. You're probably not. The only reason why you won't become a full prophet, because this is not a generation in which prophecy is prevalent or necessarily attainable. There has to be certain merits of the generation in order to attain true prophecy. But he says all Jews have an inherent internal connection with Hashem, which is really the basis of prophecy. What a prophet does is he grows in his internal connection with Hashem to the point that he doesn't just feel that he's communicating with Hashem, or that he's in touch with Hashem, but he gets a flow from Hashem in return. We might not be able to accomplish that, we get that flow, but we can work on our connection. And he gives an interesting proof for this. The Gemara in Sukkim speaks about what happened in the times of Hillel when Erev Pesach came out on Shabbos, like it does this year. And it was not permissible to carry knives from the upper city of Jerusalem to the temple. For some reason, there was no way to, I don't know exactly why. But there's no way to carry knives. So the question came before, are you sure you have enough junk today? Not sure, huh?
I don't know.
Gonna get a fat tummy, huh?
Yeah, and then tonight, if you exercise, I get tummy jokes.
The Gemara says to the Muslim of the Hitler and asked, so, what to do? How did they get the knife to the temple? So, maybe just put them in your pocket now. You can rub them off. Rub them off.
No, it's too much, Dad.
Okay. So the ones on the table is in your pocket, right?
Wipe them off.
The, I think only three went on the table. On the floor. Right? Four. Okay, so he says, so Hillel forgot. And Mora says there, the reason why he forgot is because he was a little bit haughty that day, and he forgot what to do. So he said, you know what, I don't remember what we're supposed to do, how this knife is going to be brought, but Hanachman, he said, leave the Jews be. If Enam Nevi'im, if they're not prophets, the name Nevi'im, they're the children of prophets. And the next day, what did they do? They put the knife into the wool of the goats, of the sheep they're bringing to the Beit HaMikdash, and the sheep carried the knife to the Beit HaMikdash. So the PSS says, so what if, what is Hillel saying? How come he has such confidence? So what if their father's a prophet? Just because your father's a prophet, it makes you a prophet, your father's a scholar, it makes you a scholar, you might be stupid, right? If your father is, a physically fit person, you might be, unhealthy and unfit. So he says, the name of Nevi'im, sons of Nevi'im doesn't mean the children of Nevi'im. It's just like we have a concept, he says, there's a concept of Talmud Chacham, a great sage, and there's a concept of a Ben Torah. Ben Torah is somebody who's in the realm of Torah and studies, even though he's not a great sage. So too, by Nevi'im, you have the great prophets, who are called Nevi'im, and then you have the people who are in the continuum, some are lower down, who are little Nevi'im. They're B'nai Nevi'im. B'nai Nevi'im, not children of Nevi'im, but rather the Nevi'im aspiring prophets, or prophets somewhere down the line. It says every Jew has an intuitive connection with Hashem. That intuitive connection is an internal connection. The way prophecy works is that you expand that connection to the point that you receive impulses from Hashem. But even if you don't get there, you have to build your recognition and sense of in touchiness, if we could coin a word, with Hashem, to the point that it pervades your life and is the overriding theme in your life, your connection to Hashem. And everything you do is geared towards that connection, experiencing it, enhancing it, developing it. That is the basis of Hasidus. And much of what Hasidus is about, like the singing and dancing, and all the inspirational experiences which it has, are part and parcel of experiencing this innate internal connection with Hashem. And the assumption is that the higher you get, to the point that you might become a Rebbe, the more that connection is enhanced, and the more, therefore, even if you're not a real prophet who gets a direct message from God, the more your intuition becomes a holy intuition. So the point is, things you say can be, in fact, not a direct message from God, but a divine intuition of what God would say under these circumstances. You see that? That's Hasidus. Now the Rambam has and I only began to explain because Nevuah point to Hasidus, so we'll have to explain a little bit more. But according to the Rambam, Nevuah actually is an intellectual thing. Meaning a person has to be, according to Hasidus, you don't have to be too bright to be a prophet, right? You have to work on that innate connection. You don't have to be so smart, you have to be connected. It might be better to be more emotional than smart. The Rambam knows, however, that you have to be smart in order to be a prophet. Because prophecy is a form of intellectual, An intellectual, what?
Force?
force, maybe force is the right word, an intellectual gift, I guess we would say, from Hashem, meaning that if you're very smart, and besides that you work on your holiness, and you continue to study in depth, eventually you'll get to the point that God gives you messages to your mind, right? There are certain things that come into your mind, and those are bits and pieces of more profound knowledge, and that profound knowledge becomes prophecy. If that's the case, it's prophecy. If that's the case, according to the Rambam, the person who's not so bright really shouldn't try to become a Navi. There's really no point. That's why it says, the Gemara says that Ein Shechinah Shura Al Chacham Asher V'Gibor. The divine presence only rests on a wise, rich, and powerful person. So Chazal, in Pekiel, would say, Ezu Ashir, who's a rich person. What does Pekiel say?
Happy with his what?
Happy with his what? Who's a Gibor? Who's a powerful person? What? Restrains his Yetzer Hara. Hakov Yishisa, restrains the evil inclination. So Gibor...
I know.
You do?
A guy who listens to a hymn.
Good. So a gibor and an ashir doesn't necessarily have to be taken literally. But the Mishnah of a son say Ezu Chacham, you know, something else other than being a Chacham. So therefore you have to be a Chacham in order to be a prophet. You can be gibor, can be figurative. Ashir can be figurative, right? But you have to be a Chacham, according to the Rambam. So there's a basic difference in understanding how the rule works according to the Rambam and according to the other approaches, other than the Rambam. Yeah.
Theoretically, could psychedelic drugs bring someone to prophecy?
They can't bring somebody to prophecy, no. But they can help him in theory. They can help a person, I shouldn't say this because I don't know enough about psychedelic drugs, they might just destroy mind.
Well, they make more of the brain work than...
Yeah, but in theory, perhaps some drug could exist which makes the brain work better, and therefore you can train yourself to a greater extent to experience the higher states of consciousness, which eventually will lead one to prophecy.
So, like, if you're a big Kabbalist, and you're, like, really up there, and you're very exotic, and you took a drug that made, instead of using 5% of your brain, all of a sudden you were using 35% of your brain, and you were in that sort of meditative trance before you took it, then you could possibly get to prophecy?
I assume so. The Gemara says that Chamer of a Rechani Pichin. Alcohol and fragrances make a person wise. So I'm sure it means in moderation, not in excess.
Fragrances. Right. Talk about the fragrances.
It doesn't.
You should use.
It just says fragrances.
So these aromatherapy people have something Talmudic going on.
Sure. Yeah. I don't think the Western world has explored sufficiently the concept of smell and fragrance and aroma. I think it's something which, you know, they in the ancient world, they had more knowledge of it because they made more use of it. But I, yeah.
They can't get help through TV. So.
Well, I can't get help through TV, so it doesn't work. So therefore, there's not, or a book, so therefore, smell has not become a major source, a major area of study. But it seems that the smells do have that impact, and therefore, they assume that perhaps there is some sort of drug which, you know, has a similar effect, which expands the brain.
Have you ever heard, someone told me this, that Arya Kaplan said that one of the ingredients for the...
Daddy!
Not the incense, but the...
yeah, the incense.
No, the
incense.
Daddy!
The incense was cannabis?
Yeah.
Do you know where he says that?
It's on Living Torah?
I don't know.
I think it's in Living Torah.
The Living Torah?
Living Torah in Parashat, where the Torah is discussed, is Parashat... by Kisi.
Daddy.
Yeah, and Shmuel.
Daddy.
Living Torah, what
is that? Daddy.
That's his translation of the Torah.
Daddy.
Yeah, because there's Maleh Oshah. He says that there's a part of the Torah which is called the creator of smoke. How does it create smoke? And it seems that marijuana creates smoke, and the smoke goes straight up. It goes up also in a straight line. It doesn't diffuse. And the Torah is supposed to make... supposed to have the smoke rise straight up and not to diffuse over space. So look there.
It actually goes up
pretty well.
What?
Marijuana doesn't
dissipate so much.
I couldn't tell you. I'm glad we have an expert here.
I have room
in it. Okay, so then we'll have to come back on Wednesday to Wednesday. I think we meet regular time again because it's no listen, no handle it, I think. So the Wednesday we'll come back to how exactly prophecy works according to the non-Rambam approaches, and we'll speak then about more about how a person is supposed to try to accomplish prophecy according to those approaches as well.
There's a big difference.